Seekers. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. Something terrible happened in Greece today, and I'm going to address it in the third hour of the program tonight. Suffice it to say that contrary to what I and Prairie 2 and probably millions of other progressive thinking Americans, including you, were worried about, the Greek parliament, in fact, today did pass by a very narrow margin what is called an austerity program, but what is really a destruction, an utter destruction of the middle class in Greece. We'll get to that a little bit later in the program. But I decided to focus on it in the third hour because it is a precursor, it is a harbinger of what's going to happen in this country. This country. Our country. Standard & Poor's, you know who they are? The credit rating agency. They warned today, according to the Washington Post, that the United States risks having its credit rating downgraded to selective default if it misses a debt payment by early August. The managing director of Standard & Poor's told the Reuters news agency that if the United States misses a payment due to a debt ceiling-related default brought about by the Republicans, who also brought about the crisis to begin with, U.S. Treasury bills maturing on August 4th would be rated D, as in dump. The managing director of Standard & Poor's said, quote, that would happen right after August 4th when the bills mature because they don't need a grace, they don't have a grace period, end quote. Oh, well, okay. The statement by this guy, John Chambers, is likely to add new urgency, the Washington Post reports, to the debt ceiling battle being waged by party leaders and the White House. The country hit its $14.3 trillion debt limit in mid-May. And Treasury Secretary Geithner has said the United States will go into default if Congress does not vote to raise the federal borrowing limit by August 2nd. Standard & Poor's, I know this is real boring. It's boring to me, too. But you know what? Our lives are tied up in this. Huh? I know this is economic stuff. This is where all of our eyes glaze over. But it's not economic stuff any longer. This is political stuff. This is a political party that has decided to wage all out, an American political party decided to wage all out war against the American people, except for the top 1.5%. This is like an invasion, these Republicans. I refer to them as cockroaches because it's an apt description as far as I'm concerned. But it's you know, that's cartoon talk. On a serious level, these rat bastards are like invaders. Bush and Cheney realized on December 12th, 2000, that democracy, representative government, democratic republic was ended in this country as a result of the vote of five neo-fascists on the United States Supreme Court. December 12th, 2000. And realizing what they realized, the banksters, the con artists, the casino operators on Wall Street and Washington and L.A. and wherever these cockroaches exist, they knew they had a completely open field. They could do, and they did, anything they wanted to do. The September 11, 2001 event made it even easier. Jesus God, did you think that you would be alive to see the two dates on which this Democratic Republic would end? December 12, 2000, when the United States Supreme Court said to over 50 million voters, go screw yourself. Your votes don't mean anything because we're stopping the vote count in Florida. And in doing so, they gave the country to the predatory capitalists and their puppets, George Bush and Dick Cheney. How does it feel? It feels pretty crappy to me. It feels pretty awful. And then the second event, September 11, 2001, where, if you believe the official story, 19 hijackers, 15 of whom were from the country that houses Bush's, the Bush family, Bush crime family's business partner, Saudi Arabia. Those people came to this country, if you believe the official story, and drove in the second sword. Fear. So here we are. Standard & Poor's and other rating agencies have offered warnings on this debt ceiling debate. In April, Standard & Poor's lowered its outlook on the U.S. debt from stable to negative. And Moody's, another credit rating agency, said earlier this month that if progress toward a debt limit deal isn't made by mid-July, it would move to review U.S. credit rating for a possible downgrade. These are American companies, by the way. These are the same companies. This is the same industry. I don't know if they're the same companies or not, but this is the same industry. The credit rating agencies that allowed these huge banks, banking organizations, default swaps cockroaches, allowed them all to play fast and loose with the truth, which set the United States up and hence the rest of the world for the economic chaos that we're now in. Same ratings agencies, the same industry, I should say. I don't know if they're the same companies or not. So Obama urged people today, at a press conference, to treat the August 2nd deadline as hard and fast, saying at the press conference, I'll cover that a little bit, that Congress should not delay the inevitable. He said, quote, if you know you've got to do something, just do it. Could we say the same thing about you, Mr. President? Or are you above all this? Republicans, of course, have generally expressed their determination that they don't give a goddamn if the country goes down the toilet. As a matter of fact, they want it to go down the toilet because they figure that they're safe, the elected Republicans. These poor schmucks out here in Never Never Land, United States of America, who vote Republican, boy, you folks in for a jolt. Maybe it'll be the jolt that you need. You need to have your asses kicked up around your shoulders, frankly. This hour is sponsored by Anonymous. Thanks, LD. Anonymous is turning into one of our best sponsors. Dear God, Anonymous is attempting to keep this program on the air. Anonymous will soon be able to claim us as a dependent. Thank you, Anonymous. Thank you, LD. We have a break here? Not yet? Okay. Right before the program, I got a little piece of poetry sent to me by Sheila Samples. She sent it to me. Our Oklahoma correspondent, who provides a good percentage. It varies, but Sheila provides a lot of stuff for this program, some of which I get to. Some of which I don't, but she never sends me anything that I look at and go, eh, well, maybe, maybe not, you know. But anyway, Sheila sent me a poem written by Chris Floyd. And I want to share it with you when we come back after this break. I know, you don't like, but look, the only time I really like poetry two ways. If I am half in the bag with Jack Black and I'm sitting on the back porch with the woods out behind the house and I sit there with a book of poetry and read it very quietly and then have another sip and read it and have another sip, or if I go to a poetry slam. Now, what I'm going to share with you is neither, but I think you're going to like it. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Sang out of tune, would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll
good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. All right, here it is. This is from Chris Floyd. And it's titled, One Plank in This Platform, I'm for the Poor. Now, yeah, it's written like a song. As a matter of fact, it would probably make very good song lyrics. But here it is. There's lots of politicians, philosophers, and more. They'll tell you how to run the world and what your life is for. I ain't no politician, but I've seen life from shore to shore. And you want to know my program? I'm for the poor. I'm for the poor. Yes, I'm for the poor. The sick and hungry who can't take no more. A lot of folks are savvy. They're serious. And they're smart. And they'll tell you why the rich should rule. They've got it on a chart. But they worship at the altar of a hand they cannot see. And their greedy God has gobbled up their own humanity. But I'm for the poor. Yeah, I'm for the poor. The sick and the hungry outside the door. I've spent so many years out there trying to figure out the truth. In party plans and platforms and that old voting booth, I sought a grand solution. I don't do that anymore. There's just one plank in my platform. I'm for the poor. They bombed the bombed and abused who can't take no more. I'm for the poor. Yeah, I'm for the poor. The sick and the hungry outside the door. The lost and abandoned. The racked and the sore. I'm for the poor. Yeah, I'm for the poor. Chris Floyd. The Obama press conference today was another exercise in futility where it concerns, or a demonstration of futility where it concerns his leadership and his ability to get all Harry Truman-ish on these goddamn Republicans and tell them the direction the country is going to go, rather than continuing to allow the Republicans to act as though they're in control. Sad truth is, they are in control as long as Obama allows it, but he doesn't have to allow it, and neither does the Democratic Party. But like we've said before, to continue to believe that the Democratic Party somehow is the party of the people and the Republican Party is the party of the capitalists is another exercise in futility. The Democratic Party, with a few exceptions, has completely gone over to the dark side. We all know this. But the way they do it, the way the Democrats go along with it, they let the Republicans, be the loudmouths and the hard asses, and the Democrats just sit back and let them do it. When's the last time you really saw Democrats? I'm not talking about rhetorically, but Democrats really stand up and kick ass where it concerned getting the job done in the House or the Senate. When's the last time? Remember in the when the Democrats were in the majority in the House, and they were terrified of their own shadows. I remember when they had a larger majority than they do now in the Senate, and they refused to do anything for fear. All the Republicans had to say was filibuster. And the Democrats would just start urinating all over themselves. Ooh, ooh, I can't hold my bladder. Ooh, they just scared me. Ooh, ooh, ooh. So Obama's press conference today was one more. I watched a little bit of it and then just, no, I just can't do this anymore. Can't do it. Can't even listen to it. If this president ever decides to be a real leader, if he ever decides to stop cowering in fear and anxiety in front of these worthless cockroaches that infest the House and the Senate, and they're not all Republicans, just every Republican is a cockroach. More than a few Democrats are, too. But if Obama ever decides to grow a pair, and act like a leader in a time of crisis. If he ever decides to stand up on his hind feet and say, okay, I'm at it. This is what's going to happen. Let me tell you something about bullies like Boehner and Eric Cantor and these other pricks. Let me tell you, you should know this. As soon as you get in their face and tell them, get out of my way or I'm going to beat you into the ground, however you want to interpret that, they usually flee. They just run. And then they wet their pants. But he won't do that. Obama won't do that. But I was going to say, I don't need CNN or MSNBC or the New York Times or the Washington Post to let me know if Obama ever decides to do that. I'll know because all I have to do is stand outside for a minute and hear this cheer going up from the American public that'll resonate border to border, coast to coast, across the fruited plain. You know what I'm saying?
Be afraid. Be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. This hour is sponsored by Anonymous, courtesy LD. Thank you, Anonymous. So, at his press gig today, according to the Washington Post, Obama used his harshest language yet. I didn't see any, I didn't hear or see any harsh language, body language, verbal, mouth language. No, what the hell are they talking about? The harshest language yet? Who wrote this? Zachary Goldfarb for the Washington Post. President Obama today used his harshest language yet to urge congressional Republicans to agree to end tax breaks, quote, for millionaires and billionaires, end quote, as part of a deal to reduce the annual budget deficit, blah, 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 saying the lawmakers' refusal to consider any tax increases is indefensible. Ooh, that's harsh language, Mr. Goldfarb. Harsh language. Does that mean, I guess it means that Obama didn't say, oh, come on, guys. He also predicted that Republicans would reconsider their position as the deadline nears for raising the limit on borrowing. don't you want to just slap the living hell out of somebody? I mean, don't you ever get that feeling? Every time I turn on television, every time I pick up the Times or the Post, every time I read something or hear something, I just want to slap somebody or something. I just want to grab somebody. Anybody off the street. I just get so, well, no, okay, not anybody off the street. I want to grab one of these politicians. I really do. I want to grab him by the necktie and give him that pulley up to my face kind of pull, you know what I'm saying? Just, and just look in their eyes and say, what in the hell is wrong with you? If you can't do the job, get out! And then I want to slap him. Okay, come on, you right-wing blogger freaks. You didn't cut out that little piece of sound I gave you a week ago, you scum suckers. I told you to cut it out and put it up on your right-wing pansy-ass websites, where all you cockroaches gather. I told you to do it, and you didn't do it. So cut that one out and put that up on your website. You guys are failing me. You right-wing vermin are failing me. Come on. I need the publicity. Get it up there. Malloy says he wants to slap politicians. And then in parentheses, was he referring to a physical assault on Obama? Come on. Come on, you roaches. Anyway, Obama said he is willing to cut spending. See, this is the harshest language yet. He said he's willing to cut spending on a range of programs by more than $1 trillion. $1,000 billion. What is that, Mr. President? Is that money spent for the regulatory agencies? Why, of course. Is it money spent for, like, the Department of Interior? Why, of course. Is it money... Where are you going to get $1 trillion in spending cuts? Where are you going to do it? Where are you going to do it? He says he's willing to cut spending by $1 trillion and look for ways to control entitlement costs. Entitlement. Let's see now, what would entitlement be? The only entitlement I can think of is the war budget, the weapons industry. Those sons of bitches have an entitlement. Anything they want, they go to the Republicans and the Democrats and they get it. And the Congress even tries to give them things they don't want. And why is that? Because every one of these cockroaches in the House and the Senate feed off the defense budget. So, Mr. President, I have a suggestion for you. You want to cut $1 trillion? You want to cut $1 trillion in spending? I'll tell you how to do it in 4 years. In 4 years. Just divide that trillion into fourths and take the money away from the weapons industry for the next 4 years. It's a very simple thing to do. $250 billion this year, next year, the following year, and the year after that. And there's your trillion! And you haven't taken anything away from the Women's, Infants, and Children's Funding. You haven't taken anything away from Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Oh, those are the entitlements you're talking about. Oh, I'm sorry. For a minute there, I thought you were serious, Mr. President. I really did. Honest to God, I thought you were serious when you said you were going to cut entitlements by $1 trillion. Son of a bitch, you got me again, Mr. President. Gosh darn it. I feel like Charlie Brown and you're Lucy. And you're holding that damn football, and I just keep, oh, Mr. President, you got me again. When you said entitlements, I thought you were serious. Since when is Social Security and Medicare an entitlement? Who's entitled to it? I'll tell you who. The people who paid into it. Oh, there's a couple requirements. You have to be 62 or 65 or 70. But what do you mean entitlement? It's an insurance policy. That's how Social Security was ever intended to be. And Medicare is a way for a certain segment of the population of this country to get health care. Is it abused? You're goddamn right it's abused, Mr. President. Who abuses it? The recipient of Medicare? Or the person who administers it out there in doctor's offices and hospitals and clinics? Those cockroaches. The ones that say, oh, look here. We have this patient come in. Now, what happened? Oh, he fainted? Oh, okay. Well, let's see. Let's do a brain scan. Yeah, we'll do a brain scan. Let's check for those heart enzymes. He's had a heart attack. Let's do this. So it comes up to $38,000 because somebody fainted. Why did they faint? Oh, they were dehydrated. How'd they get dehydrated? Oh, they had diarrhea and vomiting. How did that happen? They had a stomach virus. $38,000 to treat a stomach virus. Well, what the hell? He's got Medicare. I thought you were serious, Mr. President. You want to cut entitlements? Go for the biggest entitlement this country has. The one that the framers warned against. The standing military. Huh? Go for that. $250 billion this year. $250 billion next year. $250 billion the following year. $250 billion the fourth year. By God, there's $1 trillion. And you know what? You know what? That leaves plenty of money for the graft and corruption and murder and mayhem and invasions and bombings and killings and lootings. Plenty of money. You take $250 billion a year for the next 4 years, Mr. President, out of the war budget, and it still leaves you $600 billion. Now, if you were really serious, Mr. President, if you were really serious, here's what you would do. You would order whoever still follows your orders in Congress, in the Democratic Party, to offer up a bill that provided all the money necessary to upgrade our nuclear weapons arsenal. Now, I'm going to come at you here, Mr. President, like a real warmonger, because I really don't believe this. I think if you were a true leader, you would get rid of these weapons. But since you're not, and since we live in crazy America, we live in an armed madhouse, let's do it this way, because we're talking about cutting the budget now. We're talking about saving some money now. We're talking about cutting $1 trillion. So anyway, you go to your shills in Congress, if you still have any, and you say, okay, boys, I realize you're not a Harry Truman or a Lyndon Johnson. I understand that. Or even a Dick Nixon. So you go to your shills in Congress and say, okay, boys, here's what we'll do, and girls. Appropriate enough money to upgrade our nuclear arsenal. Make all those nuclear weapons just absolute, by God, ready to launch at a moment's notice. And let's get rid of everything else. No? That wouldn't give you any leeway where it concerns in Iraq or in Afghanistan or Pakistan or a Libya or a Yemen. That's kind of the point, Mr. President. What the hell are we doing in those countries anyway? It's called the Defense Department. Isn't that a joke? Defense. What does that mean? That means we have enough armaments that if we're ever attacked, we can defend. When did Iraq attack us? When did Vietnam attack us? When did the Dominican Republic attack us? When did the Philippines attack us? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm yelling again. Let's take a break. Been sponsored by Anonymous via LD. Thank you, Anonymous. Thank you very, very much. Anonymous will soon be able to claim us as a dependent. I'm posting a link at our website, MikeMalloy.com. It's a speech Bernie Sanders gave. You know, I talk about the cockroaches in the House and the Senate. I'm certainly not referring to Bernie Sanders, but then again, he's not a Democrat or a Republican, is he? What I'm posting, and it came from Sheila, is the transcript of Bernie Sanders' 90-minute speech on the budget that he delivered yesterday. If you're looking for what's wrong and why things are wrong, read this. Just read it. Yes, it's lengthy. You don't have to read it now. Just, you know, this evening, tomorrow, whatever. Read it. And then realize what this country would be like if we had a bunch of Bernie Sanders in government. And Sanders is socialist. What? Socialist. What? He's an independent. He's a socialist. Obama went on today. He said, like I said, he's willing to cut more than $1 trillion in spending on a range of programs. He doesn't have to do that. All he's got to do is cut $250 billion a year for 4 years out of the weapons industry. These filthy, degenerate bastards who have also convinced the American public that they have to have, the Defense Department has to have $800 billion a year. That's almost $1 trillion right there. But, you know, I'm not saying gut it completely. Just dial it back. Just a bit. But they got America convinced, don't they? The weapons industry and their pig shills in Congress. Most of whom are from the South. The pig shills. And the West. Obama said, quote, it would be hard for Republicans to stand there and say that the tax break for corporate jets is sufficiently important that we're not willing to come to the table and get a deal done. What we've seen in negotiations here in Washington is a lot of people say a lot of things to satisfy their base or to get on cable news, end quote. Ooh, the harshest language yet, according to Zachary Goldfarb in the Washington Post. Ooh, Zachary. What kind of a life have you lived? That's harsh language? I'll tell you harsh language. Here you go, Zachary. Hey, you sons of bitches! Hey, you filthy Republicans, get your asses in here! Work this deal out, God damn you! Or I'm going to take one of these SEAL teams and put them on your tail! Now move it! That, Zachary, is harsh language. What Obama said today was not harsh at all. It was more whining. He went on to say, you know, they need to do their job, referring to the lawmakers. They need to do their job. And the lawmakers should have to cancel their summer recess trips if they can't strike a deal, you know? Really? He compared it to his daughters. He compared the stalling of these freaks with his two daughters' efficiency, saying that if Malia and Sasha could do their homework on time, there's no reason that Congress should be taking so long to work out a plan. Ooh, that is so harsh, Zachary. Oh my God. How could you stand to write this in the hallowed pages of the Washington Post? That is so harsh. The harshest language yet. Ooh, my goodness. They need to do their job, Obama said. And then after that, House Speaker John Boehner sobered up long enough to say that, well, you know, Republican lawmakers, where was I? Where's that piece of paper? Wait a minute. Oh, here it is. Republican lawmakers are not going to back down from our stand against any tax increases. We're just not going to do it. The president is sorely mistaken. You know what sorely mistaken means? You know, that's when you have too much to drink, you fall on your ass and your butt sore. That's a joke from Ohio there. The president is sorely mistaken if he believes... Right. If he believes a bill to raise the debt ceiling and raise taxes would pass the House, the votes simply aren't there, and they're not going to be there. What time is it? Is it 5 o'clock yet around here? It's 5 o'clock somewhere, goddammit. Oh, excuse me. Did I say goddammit? I'm a Christian. I'm Catholic, I think. Am I Catholic? I don't know. What am I? Where's my aide? Where? Hey, come here. What am I? Am I okay? It's time to drink. Time for a glass of wine? Wait a minute. You know, because American people know tax hikes destroy jobs. I mean, look at Bill Clinton. He raised taxes on the top 2%, and he created 22 million jobs, and he left a huge budget surplus as far... What? Oh, I'm not supposed to say that. Oh, I'm sorry. God damn it. I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to say that either. I don't know. You know, tax hikes destroy jobs. American people know that Washington's been on spending binge for many years. And, all right, listen. I gotta go. It's time to go. I'll meet you guys down at the bar. I mean, down at the restaurant. I'll see you in a few minutes. We're not gonna submit to this bully in the White House with a tax increase, with the tax increases. What time is it? Tuning in. Our two sponsor tonight is Andy Porter. Thank you, Andy. His message, lost in a wilderness of discontent and insanity. Yeah, aren't we all, Andy? A voice calls out from my radio and reminds me that I'm not alone. Thanks, Mike, for vocalizing so well the angst, concern, and troubles of my heart. Well, thank you, Andy, for sponsoring the program. Angst, concern, and troubles of my heart. By God, you know, I feel the same thing, right, Candy? I wander around the house all day talking about the angst, concern, and troubles in my heart. Boy, you got that right. Thanks, Andy. I don't want to keep this topic alive beyond its expiration date, but Obama today, there was more than just the... harshest language yet, Zachary Goldfarb at the Washington Post calls it. Where did these people come from? Where did you learn to write, Zachary? Seriously, the harshest language yet, when the president stands up there and just kind of bleats and well, you know, they should do the right thing. I mean, my daughters have to do homework and they usually get it done. Well, the Republicans have to do their work too. Harsh language? Oh my God. At the press conference, Obama also called for Congress to take action to bolster the economy, urging lawmakers to extend a payroll tax cut. Now, you'd think that that's exactly what Republicans, I mean, they're always talking about cutting taxes. Last December, remember, Congress agreed to slash the payroll tax for employees from 6.2% to 4.2%. Woohoo! That put about, an extra $3-4 in everybody's pocket every time you get a paycheck. Hot damn! That was supposed to, boost consumer spending and bolster the economy, right? Republicans have opposed, including a payroll tax cut measure and the deficit deal. Why? Because Obama suggests it. So Republicans want to raise taxes on workers. Do you understand this, truth seekers? If the payroll tax is left where it is, it was cut from 6.2 to 4.2%. If it's left there, the Republicans will fight tooth and nail to have it removed. Why? I don't know why. But the tax on the wealthiest people in this country, the tax cut that the Bush crime family put into play, if that is rescinded, if that tax cut is rescinded, all hell breaks loose. The gates of hell open and demons spill out onto the surface of the earth, devouring, slashing, burning, eating children, raping men, seducing women, pulling the sky into a little envelope, causing the sun to collapse into itself. Darkness reigns! But the payroll tax cut for working people? No, no. So, in the harshest language yet, according to Zachary Goldfarb at the Washington Post, Obama said that the lawmakers should extend the payroll tax cut, make loans to build new roads, reform patents. Okay. And advance trade deals. Woohoo! Obama then went on in the harshest language yet, and he said, quote, "The truth is our economic challenges are not going to be solved overnight. There are a number of steps Congress could be taking right now that would help put more Americans back to work." Oh, I'm sorry. It's just that whenever I see that phrase, help put more Americans back to work, I start to go to sleep. I start to numb out. A film starts to go over my brain. I can't think. Put more Americans. See? If Barack Obama or the Democrats or the Republicans or anybody really wanted to put more Americans back to work, it could be done. Okay, give it 30 days with the Congress and the president working together. First of all, to absolutely destroy, burn, tear up, and leave NAFTA. Just get out of it. Tell the World Trade Organization to bite our asses and get out of that. Slap a tariff on every single product that comes into this country that is made by an American manufacturer who has moved their business overseas. Boom! Problem solved. Boy, that was hard. Christ, I've worked up a sweat here in the Malloy studio. Man, I'm exhausted. There are a number of steps Congress could be taking right now that would help put more Americans back to work. And too bad, Mr. President, that neither you nor the Congress will ever, under any circumstances, get to those steps for a very simple reason. Your overlords will not let you. And you know it. They don't care about the rhetoric, President Obama. You can do all the rhetoric you want to do because, you know, you hook us. You certainly hooked me enough times. I bet you'd be a nice man to go have a beer with.
Yeah, well, you can ask me about that. I have beers with the president. What time is it? I'm the Speaker of the House, and every once in a while, what? Oh, I don't go have a beer with? Who is it then I'm having a beer with? It's a color guy. I thought it was him. Oh, it's not? Oh, it isn't? It's who? My driver? Oh, never mind.
The harshest language yet. Obama was also questioned about U.S. participation in the Libya operation. Libya operation. No, an operation is when you have bypass surgery or your tonsils removed. What is going on in Libya is more murder from the skies. Oh, I know. There's good guys and bad guys and yada, yada, yada. And we certainly, I don't know. It looks like, it smells like a civil war. I don't know what's going on there. I have no idea because the American news media does not inform me. It's none of my business. This is only the business of the banksters and the capitalists and the corporatists. They have an interest in this. We working class Americans have... Anyway... He was questioned about U.S. participation in the Libya operation and whether his decision to send warplanes without congressional approval is legal. I'd like to know who asked that question. I really would. If I were the president, I'd pull his press pass. Not because he asked a penetrating question, but because the question is on its face such a dumb-ass question. Of course he's not allowed to do it, Mr. Crack Reporter! But he did it anyway! As every president since FDR has done. Go all the way back. Go all the way back to Truman, Mr. Crack Reporter! Is it legal? Why, hell no. Was Grenada legal? Vietnam? Korea? Dominican Republic? Bay of Pigs? Was it legal? Jesus. The hour coming up next hour. What has happened in Greece today? The setup to what has happened, why it happened the way it happened. We're going to be talking about it. It is a harbinger of the possibilities of what's going to happen in this country. The irony of what happened in Greece. Greece. The Greek Parliament today sold everything to the capitalists, to the corporatists, to the people who have no respect for representative government. Greece, the seat of Western democracy, you know, where it all started for people of a certain nationality and race. I'm not saying that, you know, 3,000 years ago, there weren't indigenous tribes around the world who were practicing representative government. But we don't know about them because it was not politically correct to teach us about them. So let's go, even if we go kicking and screaming, with history as it's written. The Greeks, the seat of democracy, where it all started. And today, it was just beaten to death by an elected parliament. You appreciate irony? You gotta appreciate that, truth seeker. So that's coming up next hour. Asked whether he believed the War Powers Resolution is constitutional. Obama said at his press conference today, the War Powers resolution that he is not following. So I don't understand the question from this half-assed reporter. I don't know who the reporter was, but a typical crack White House press corps. This harkens back to the Bush era, right? But when asked if he believed the War Powers Resolution's constitution, Obama wouldn't answer. He said he's not a Supreme Court justice. Oh, okay. Good answer, Mr. President. You're not a Supreme Court justice. Huh. Well, you know, John Boehner is not a rat, but I'm sure he likes cheese with his wine. Okay, he is a rat. Never mind. I don't know where I was going with that. He said, Obama did, that the contention from lawmakers that the bombing and now the blatant attempt of assassination, the bombing of Libya and the attempt to assassinate Muammar Gaddafi, that mission, now in its fourth month, requires congressional approval. He said that argument is too focused on process rather than on the substance of the operation. What? Now, at that point, of course, the little jerk-ass reporter who asked the question immediately sat down in his seat and attempted to control the sphincter muscle because he was about to poopy in his pants. He didn't know what the hell the president just said. That question is too, or the Congress is too focused on process rather than the substance of the operation.
What, Mr. President? I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said.
Sit down.
Okay.
Mr. Obama defended the action to oust, to murder, to assassinate Muammar Gaddafi. They used the word oust. Roust, middu! Oust! Oust! Why do you use the word oust? Why not say kill? That's what this is all about. Why not put it this way? Who's the guy who wrote all this crap? Is this Zachary? I'm still doing Zachary Goldfarb of the Washington Post. Mr. Goldfarb, rather than saying he defended the effort to try to oust Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, why don't you put it this way? I think your readers would appreciate it more. Your editors might not, but I think your readers would, Mr. Goldfarb. Put it this way. He defended the effort to try to murder Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi and said that he has followed the original parameters he set out for U.S. participation. Why not put it that way, Mr. Goldfarb? Use the word murder. I realize that's a legal term, but goddammit, go ahead, take a risk. What are your employers going to do? What's the Washington Post going to do, fire you? It'll never make print. You just have some editor hand you back the copy and say, Zachary, you can't say murder.
Well, what should I say?
Try the word oust.
Oh, okay. Oust.
I'll be right back.
It's Mike Malloy.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? 25 before the hour. This hour is sponsored by Andy Porter. Andy writes, lost in a wilderness of discontent and insanity, a voice calls out from my radio and reminds me that I'm not alone. Thanks, Mike, for vocalizing so well the angst, concern, and troubles of my heart. Thank you, Andy, for sponsoring the program. This hour of the program, I appreciate it very much. President Obama today. Regarding the mission, now in its fourth month, against Libya. Mr. President said, quote, we have carried out that narrow mission in exemplary fashion. Narrow mission. The original UN, was it UN or was it NATO? Well, was it a UN resolution that allowed this to happen? I think it was a UN resolution. This NATO-led bombing spree that is increasingly targeting the capital, Tripoli. I didn't realize that the I'm not trying to be a smartass here. I didn't realize the resolution called for an all-out air war against Libya. But apparently it did. And an all-out air war, of course, does not require congressional anything. It never has. Not since December 9th, 1941. Was it December 9th? I think so. I think it was December 9th. December 10th? 9th? 1941, for Christ's sake. That's even before I was born. And no war since. No military action in almost 70 years has had the has had the permission, the constitutional, legal endorsement of the U.S. Congress. Imprimatur. Thank you. We have carried out that narrow mission in exemplary fashion, Mr. President said. Now, regarding gay marriage, I hope I'm not driving you crazy parsing the president's press conference today. I hope I'm not. I'm sorry. You know, stick around for the next hour when we get into violence and death and destruction in Greece, the seat of democracy that has had its death warrant signed today. We'll get to that. But Mr. Obama gave another characteristically careful message on the issue of gay marriage. Yeah, characteristically careful, Mr. Goldfarb says. You're right there, pal. You got that one, Zachary. He praised New York's passage of a gay marriage bill, but stopped short of endorsing the practice himself. Well, how about that? See, you know, just like people who believe in a woman's right to privacy where it concerns her reproductive system, why they call it a woman's right to choose has always just baffled me. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with a woman's right to privacy. How did this start? Who came up with the meme, a woman's right to choose, that the right-wing Christian freakoids in this country have had just absolute, just use that expression. It's not a choice, it's a baby. They have used it and used it. It has nothing to do with abortion and everything to do with a woman's right to privacy. Her doctor, her partner, if she has one, herself, and her concept of ethical or moral behavior. It's her business, her privacy. Woman's right to choose sounds like, what is she choosing? A dress color? Whether or not to have an appendectomy? A diet? It is a woman's right to privacy. And as far as gay marriage, it is not about gay marriage. It is about denying a segment of the population
equal protection as guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution and the right to form a contract if they choose to. And isn't it interesting? Both of these issues, denying a woman's right to privacy, denying a segment of the population's right to form a contract, both issues driven, beaten, pushed, screamed by the Christian right. The same group that drives, pushes, and screams about making more war and doing more bombing. Yes, sons of bitches. Man. He said, the president, quote, "This administration, under my direction, has consistently said we cannot discriminate as a country against people on the basis of sexual orientation," end quote. Well, Mr. Obama, I've said many, many, many times that I wish I could sprout wings and fly. It would save me an awful lot of money on these goddamn airline tickets. But because I say it, that doesn't mean anything. I can't sprout wings. You could. Order your administration to get to work to end this Defense of Marriage bill, the Defense of Marriage Act. We have consistently said we cannot discriminate while you continue to discriminate. Oh, man. He went on, "And we've done more in the 2.5 years that I've been in here than the previous 43 presidents to uphold that principle. Whether it's ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell, making sure that gay and lesbian partners can visit each other in hospitals, making sure that federal benefits can be provided to same-sex couples across the board." So your sense of accomplishment, Mr. Obama, as far as the American people are concerned, we're supposed to, those of us who still are able to listen to you and not start screaming, "He's speaking Kenyan." What we're supposed to believe is that you have done all these things, but the one basic thing, equal protection under the law, where it concerns making a contract to get married, which religious institutions have not a damn thing to do with. It is sanctioned, or it is blessed, if you will, by the state. The state. "Now by the power vested in me by the state of Minnesota, I pronounce you man and wife. Now by the power vested in me by the state of Florida, I pronounce you husband and wife. Now by the power vested in me by the state of..." You notice a repeating pattern there? The power vested in me by the state. Oh, well. He said he thinks the country is seeing a, quote, "profound recognition," end quote, of the rights of gay and transgendered citizens. Obama predicted, quote, "And I think that principle will win out. I think we're moving in a direction of greater equality, and I think that's a good thing," end quote. So all the people in this country, Mr. President, who would like to be able to make a contract under the laws of the federal laws, the guarantees of the Constitution, if that contract involves marriage and they have to be of the same sexual orientation, it's not going to happen. Let me give you an unintended consequence of the Defense of Marriage Act. I saw this on CNN this morning. A couple, two women, they're legally married. They are legally married. I forget which state they were married in, but they are legally married. One of the two people in this couple is not an American citizen. If I remember the story correctly, she has been here on a green card, on a visa that allowed her to be here for a certain amount of time. That time is running out. Her legally married partner wants to sponsor her for a green card and eventual citizenship. The partner is an American, born and bred. The woman who is facing deportation because her visa has run out is married legally to an American. But she cannot stay. You know why? Because the Defense of Marriage Act prohibits same-sex couples from receiving any benefits under U.S. law. How about that? No government benefits are allowed to same-sex couples. So here's a couple who is legally married. One of the two is an American citizen. If that person were male, say, and the other person in this marriage were female, which she is, there would be no problem. You see how this works out? This is what the Republican rat bastards, beaten into submission by their Christian crazy leaders, has done to people. So the marriage is going to be dissolved. Defense of Marriage Act, my ass.
Listen to right-wing radio. Here's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Andy Porter, whose message is lost to the wilderness of discontent and insanity. Hey, I'm right there with you, pal. A voice calls out from my radio and reminds me that I'm not alone. Thanks, Mike, for vocalizing so well the angst, concern, and troubles of my heart. You're more than welcome, Andy, and thank you very much for sponsoring an hour of the program tonight. I do appreciate it. You know, don't laugh. It is, if you are laughing, I'm not talking to Kathy, I'm talking to the audience here. Don't laugh about that sentence, because it's true. You know it is, if you're honest with yourself. Angst, concern, and troubles. You know you got them in your heart, too. I damn sure do. How can you not? Hi. from Kay Petrini, our education affairs correspondent, who is a school teacher in San Francisco, right? Hi, Mike. I've been working on this piece for a while now, mostly in my head, but after hearing you ask the question on last night's show yet again, what's it going to take? I decided to just get my thoughts down on paper. Sorry if they seem kind of unpolished. This was a rush job. Based on media coverage, I think I may have been the only person in America who actually celebrated the end of the Oprah Winfrey show earlier this month. Although she's done many positive things, her book club, opening schools for girls, etc., Oprah lost me at about the time that she became a religion. A religion that, like all the others, is based on magical thinking. In traditional religion, the mantra is to pray earnestly and God will answer. In the Church of Oprah, the mantra involves two laws, which, if followed, will result in the practitioner receiving whatever he or she desires. The first is the law of intention. The second is the law of attraction. Mike, I firmly believe that the popularity of this modern-day snake oil provides at least part of the answer to your almost daily question regarding the apathy of most Americans. What's it going to take? Here's a partial transcript from one of Larry King's interviews with the former queen of daytime television, which illustrates the Oprah doctrine. Larry King. The number one book in the United States now, running for a long time, is The Secret. What do you make of this, Winfrey? Well, what I make of it is I was really very excited that this line of thinking, this level of, I call consciousness, has reached the masses in such a way that that book could be number one. I was really very excited about it because basically the message of The Secret is the message that I've been trying to share with the world on my show for the past 21 years. The message is that you're really responsible for your life. You're responsible for your life. I've known this since The Color Purple. In 1985, I did The Color Purple. Prior to that, I had read the book. This is when I got the secret thing, Larry, and I didn't know it was called The Secret. I read the book and then went out and got books for everybody else I knew. I was obsessed about this story. I ate, slept, thought all the time about The Color Purple. I moved to Chicago. I get a call from a casting agent. I've never gotten a call in my life from anybody for a movie or anything like that. And I ask, is it The Color Purple? And he says, no, it's a movie called Moonsong. And I go, well, I've been praying for The Color Purple. And I go to the audition, and of course it was The Color Purple. I audition, I don't hear anything for months. I'm praying and crying and singing this song. I surrender all to thee, my blessed Savior, I surrender all. A woman comes up to me and she says, there's a phone call for you. And the phone call was Steven Spielberg saying, I want to see you in my office in California tomorrow. Now, what I learned from that moment absolutely changed my life forever because I had drawn The Color Purple into my life. I didn't know Steven Spielberg. I didn't know Quincy Jones, who saw me on 8 a.m. Chicago and said, that's Sophia. I didn't know him. I didn't know anybody that had anything to do with The Color Purple, but I knew that I had drawn that into my life, and it changed the way I thought about my life forever. End quote. Oprah. So, Kay writes, if we are to believe in the religion of Oprah, everything that happens in our lives is due to what's going on in our minds. We have to consciously want success, even be obsessed with it in order to attract it. Same goes for money, or the right partner, the right job, the right house, health, happiness, you name it. Visualize it, be intentional about it, and it will become reality. Of course, the opposite is also true. If you're not intentional, you will not attract the things you want into your life. It will not become reality. Do you see the common denominator here? It's the same bullcrap that allows all religious leaders to give their followers formulas to follow and to escape responsibility when they don't work. As a child, I was indoctrinated into the logic of traditional prayer. If God answered your prayer, you were a good boy or a good girl. If God didn't answer your prayer, you'd better become a good boy or good girl. Either way, it was never God's or the preacher's responsibility. It was yours. In the religion of Oprah, we not only have the usual pull yourself up by your own bootstraps philosophy at work, we have the added responsibility of thinking the right thoughts in order to attract success to ourselves. The implication is clear. Work hard, think correctly, and you can be like Oprah. And if you don't achieve what she and other extraordinarily wealthy individuals have, it's your fault. Mike, I honestly think this so-called philosophy is at the very least partially to blame for Americans' indifference to the economic catastrophe that continues to unfold. I mean, if you believe that all it takes is intention, why worry about healthcare costs? Or the fact that all but one of your neighbors is unemployed? Just get busy intending to be successful so that you can attract it. We don't need the government to create a safety net. The people who fall through the cracks do so by their own failure to draw economic success into their lives. Come on, folks. Whether it's the magical thinking of traditional religion or the religion of Oprah, it's time for Americans to wake the F up. Kay. You can read her stuff at kaysreportcard.com. We'll be back. We're going to talk about Greece. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. Like I mentioned earlier in the program, I wanted to get to the situation in Greece. Because it is a reflection, or we are a reflection, or something, of it's a reflection of what is going to happen in this country. This is what the Republicans are pushing the country toward. Now, whether or not American citizens will react the way Greek citizens have reacted is open for debate. How big is Greece? Under 20 million people, isn't it? I mean, what, anybody know what the population of Greece is? Let me see here. What does it say the population of Greece really, really is? I think it is under 20 million, but I think it's more like about 12 million. Let me see here. Okay, just a second, damn it. All right, so what? I didn't do my homework? All right. Anyway, I want you to consider something. As you hear this these reports of the rioting in the streets, the some of the people using rods and iron bars to break off chunks of marble to throw at the police. When you hear about the police firing tear gas and concussion grenades, when you see the images on television, try to remember what caused this. It's the same situation, or the same cause, that brought about the financial crisis in this country. There is a group, a class, an elite that is global now, that is so determined to, through their greed, to suck every possible thing they can out of every single economy that exists, that they'll stop at nothing. If it means that millions of Greeks now are going to suffer horribly because of what the parliament did today, that doesn't bother the elites at all. They couldn't care less. If it means in this country that women and infants and children who, through no fault of their own, are no longer able to sustain, provide the very basic sustenance to themselves, food, for Christ's sake. That, when weighed against the greed and filth of the capitalists, the sick demand that their corporate jets run on time, that their vacation homes, if they want to make them 40,000 square feet, so be it. When the welfare of the common people under this global system of predatory capitalism is weighed against the greed of the elites, the greed of the elites wins every time, even to the point of bringing down governments, to destroying currencies, to putting tens of millions of people out of work. It doesn't matter. The greed of these rat bastards knows no boundaries. The Koch brothers here in America are a classic example. How much wealth do you have to control before you retire from the field and say, okay, $40 billion, that's enough? These filthy cockroaches would not be able to spend their wealth if they lived 20 lifetimes, which they won't. But the greed gene, apparently it's a gene, inside this filth just is unrelenting. It doesn't matter who suffers, who dies of hunger, disease, poverty. It doesn't matter. The Greek people said, we're not going to do this. We're not going to allow our country to be taken over by the corporatists. Well, guess what? As reported by the Times, the Greek parliament
has passed a bitterly contested package of austerity measures. Austerity measures. Austerity, that's the new word for starvation. That's the new word for unemployment. That's the new word for the destruction of the middle class. That's the new word for the creation of a vast class of poor people globally. Austerity measures. It passed today, clearing the way for international lending. I wonder where that's going to come from. Huh? International lending to stop Greece defaulting on the money that they owe. Who do they owe the money to? Do they owe the money to, for the most part, workers? How about postal workers? How about people working fields? Olive growers? Taxi drivers? To whom does the Greek government owe the money? Could it be that they owe it to the international banksters, the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, the European Union? And how did Greece get into so much debt? Is it because they are lazy, spendthrift individuals? Or is it because tax revenues evaporated when the international banksters came up with all sorts of plans to steal everything they could get their goddamn hands on, which resulted in a global economic collapse, which resulted in jobs disappearing, which resulted in a precipitous drop in taxes that normally would have gone into the bankers' pockets anyway. So here they are. That's what happened. It is not because the Greeks all of a sudden a couple of years ago say, hey, let's all get greedy and lazy. Now, that's the meme that's being put out there by an awful lot of people in this country, a lot of people in the international community who have decided that they are going to get their money out of Greece. It doesn't matter how many people suffer and die. They don't care. The vote in the Greek parliament was 155-138 for the austerity measures, for poverty, for the destruction of the Greek economy. 155-38. Now, with that vote, a serious obstacle has been removed so that the European Union, the European Central Bank, and the IMF has said, if you do this, we'll release $17 billion. What was the cost for this? Wage cuts, tax increases that should have been considered a long time ago, the privatization of about $72 billion in state assets. See, the international banksters don't like any kind of a public ownership. They call it socialism. Some of them, the jerkasses, still call it communism. So what is on the block now? The state electric utility, the Greek electric utility, the Public Power Corporation, that's the name of it. What else? Ports, shipping ports, airports, rail systems. What else? The list just goes on and on and on. We mentioned it last night, Prairie 2 wrote last night in his piece about what is on the block, what is now going to pass from the hands of the Greek people to the international banking and nudge-nudge, wink-wink, investing community, many of whom are centered right here in the United States. We'll be right back.
to the Flying Monkey Right. It's more Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. The great thing. Greek Parliament today approved this so-called austerity plan, which means the elimination of the Greek middle class, and it means the further enrichment of the banksters around the planet, who are determined through their greed to steal everything they can get their hands on. The problem in Greece, of course, is not the fault of George Papandreou, the Greek prime minister, and his center-left party. It is the result of the operation of the so-called New Democracy Party that was in control. As a matter of fact, Papandreou told the opposition party leader, Antonis Samaras, today, quote, all of Europe knows that your party's responsible for the current situation. And what he was talking about, the debt that ballooned in 2009 when the so-called New Democracy Party was in power. Now, like in this country, the center-left government of Papandreou, not that Obama's center-left, you know, don't get me wrong, he's right-wing, but the similarity between the crisis in this country and the crisis in Greece can be found to some degree in the fact that Obama, as crappy a leader as he is, has made some efforts to work with the Republican Party, the opposition party, and he's gotten nothing, absolutely nothing. Matter of fact, the Republicans are bound and determined to bring the United States all the way down to its knees, and they're very close to doing that. Now, back to the Greek thing, as Prairie 2 said last night, the Greeks will now lose their electric grid, their waterworks, their gas companies, their railways, their airports, their seaports, post offices, telecom company, defense factories, public land and buildings, stadiums, tourist attractions, important landmarks. All of this has been put on the block by the demands from the international banksters of the Greek parliament, backed into a corner. Fearful, scared to death, said, okay, sure, by a vote margin of about, what, 15 votes. So what happens to the Greek people? Well, there has been some reaction that's been building. A general strike disrupted services across Greece. There have been demonstrations that a right-winger would call riots. Outside Parliament yesterday and today, it's just the unions called this 2-day general strike Tuesday. It halted just about everything in Greece, all public transport, forcing airlines to reschedule or cancel flights. Public services came to a standstill. How are the Greek people supposed to react? In this country, we don't do a goddamn thing. We do nothing. We sit back on our asses and let it just swirl around us until finally we're going to realize that this little American exceptionalist democracy, republic, whatever you want to call it, that we thought we had is now a wholly owned subsidiary. It more or less is now. But we will become wholly owned subsidiaries of the capitalists of corporate America. You know it's happening. You know it's happening. Even if you right wingers who listen to this program, you know it's happening. The problem with you people, you don't give a goddamn. You couldn't care less because you are non-inventive. You are cowards. You have no courage, no spine, no backbone, nothing. But you love to stand up on your hind legs and say, well, they ought to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. When did you ever do that? So anyway, United States, in the meantime, we just sit back and let this happen. We're just watching this. Oh, isn't that sad? Well, geez, I don't know. It's going to affect the stock market. It's going to affect the bond market. It's going to affect this. It's going to affect that. Right? We are spending billions. Billions. Actually, like I mentioned earlier, $3.7 trillion in the past decade to fund the capitalist wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. $3.7 trillion. And we couldn't help the Greeks? There is no democracy
in any of the countries I just mentioned that we have pumped money into. Not a slice, not a dollop. Greece is the cradle of democracy. Greece was under military rule for how many years? 20 years? 15 years? Until they finally got democracy back. And what is United States doing? What is our government, our State Department? What are we doing? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And do you understand why? Because the government of the United States, like the government of damn near every single country on earth that has assets, that used to have a representative form of government, is now totally and completely owned outright by the capitalists. Does that bother you?
Make this place my place. I ask for providence to smile upon me with his sweet face. But I'll tell you, my place is of the sun, and this place is of the dark.
The Mike Malloy Show. All substance, no abuse.
So, just that issue of why we are willing to spend billions on corrupt dictators such as Hamid Karzai or whoever is the dictator of Pakistan now, the puppet or two or three that we have in Iraq. We spend billions every year, billions upon billions of dollars. What's the difference? You know, here is the struggling democracy, the actual seat of democracy, where it all started, at least in the Western canon, where it all started. In the European canon is what I'm trying to say. You know what I'm saying. And what are we doing? What is the United States doing? Nothing. Nothing. I want to quote to you some of the things that Arianna Huffington, who is Greek, has written at Huffington Post after her most recent, very recent visit there. She asked a question, can a truly a democratic movement break the stranglehold of corrupt elites and powerful anti-democratic institutional forces that have come to characterize not just the politics of Greece, but most Western democracies, including our own? Greece is only an extreme example of unfolding seismic social shift that is challenging democracies the world over. What happens in Greece, she writes, might very well tell us whether democracy will recover from the crisis of legitimacy exacerbated by the financial crisis, or whether it will shrink, undermined by the very forces that brought on the crisis in the first place. Well, to digress from Arianna Huffington's piece, which was posted yesterday, that vote in the parliament a Greek parliament, has been taken now, so the answer to her question is self-evident. She goes on, it's way too early to tell whether the forces of democracy, globally, she means, will prevail, but I came away extraordinarily moved and heartened by the courage, passion, engagement, and dedication I witnessed during a trip in which three different perspectives converged. First and foremost, there was the square. The happenings in Cairo's Tahrir Square led the news for weeks earlier this year. But from what we are being shown back in America, you wouldn't know that there's a remarkably similar scene unfolding in Athens. Not only are the physical setting, the demographics of the participants, and the way they're being organized similar to Tahrir Square, but so are the demands being made. In Athens, the place of the movement attracting thousands of people a day is Syntagma Square, situated directly across from the Greek Parliament. Of course, the young are well represented here. No surprise when unemployment among Greek youth runs as high as 40%. But I was struck by the wide range of participants, young, old, activists, pensioners, unemployed, self-employed. They're all there every day, every night. As you'd expect, various political parties and organized groups are trying to co-opt the square. Indeed, on Tuesday, a demonstration of 20,000 protesters that started peacefully disintegrated when a group of mostly young people began hurling stones at the police. I digress from Arianna Huffington and would suggest that in her youth, she might have done the same. Back to what she wrote. Everywhere I went, I was stunned by the level of engagement. It's not just those physically at the square who are all in. The sense I came away with was that they're all in. Waiters, taxi drivers, shopkeepers, salespeople, anybody sitting next to you at dinner, they're all talking about the same thing. A writer said, quote, the experience of standing daily and confronting the parliament opposite has changed the politics of Greece for good and made the elites worried for the first time. Their common demand is that the corrupt political elites, this is what the people are demanding, who have ruled the country for some 30 years and brought it to the edge of collapse, should go. End quote. I digress again. Isn't that what we should be demanding in this country? Isn't that why Greece has a population, what did I say earlier, about 15 million. And if you have 500,000 people in the streets, wouldn't that be the same in this country of having, what, 30 million in the streets? Probably more than that. I don't have a calculator in front of me, but you get the point. 1/6 of the Greek population. That'd be about 45 million Americans, wouldn't it? 45 million Americans in the street. You'll pardon my cynicism when I say there are two chances of that happening. Slim and none. Arianna Huffington. What happens in Greece, she writes, is not so different from what has been happening in America. A few profit, but when the chickens come home to roost, the pain is not equally distributed, and what happens is suddenly everybody's fault. No, it isn't. No, it isn't. She goes on. The problem, or the question, Papandreou is facing is whether any politician remotely associated with the old guard, he comes from an old family, a political family, however well-intentioned, can be the one to tap into all the Greek resources and build on what has been awakened. Yes, Greece is corrupt, and the problems exist at all levels. It's a place where playing by the rules came to be seen as for suckers only, creating a system of clientelism in which attaching yourself to a powerful individual or political machine for income was seen as the smart thing to do. Sound familiar? A place where rules, playing by the rules, came to be seen as for suckers only. Huh? Sound familiar? Arianna goes on. But now people are rushing, quite literally, to re-engage in civic life. They want to start fresh and awaken the public good. They want a real democracy again. And my daily interaction with Greeks during my visit was a reminder of the incredible talents and abilities and resources that are being wasted. Who's she talking about? Is she talking about us or is she talking about Greece? It's interchangeable, isn't it? She goes on. Nevertheless, the media's focus is on the shrunken and pinched debate about austerity. Instead of a debate about how to tap into the human and natural resources Greece teems with, all we hear is about how deeply services should be cut. Sound familiar? Well, the Greeks don't do pinched very well. They're an expansive lot, and if any people can pry open this dangerously narrow debate with their humanity, it's the Greeks. Because this isn't just a policy debate. It's a debate about what the big outlines of what we call democracy are going to be for the next century. The forces of the status quo would have you believe austerity is the answer. That it's the answer in Greece, the answer in Spain, the answer in the UK, the answer in the US. But it's also clear that it's not just the Greeks who want something more out of civic life than they're currently getting. And she goes on, there's more. You can read this at Huffington Post. But that line where she says the forces of the status quo would have you believe austerity is the answer. Yeah, the answer for you and me, we you see, you and I, we are part of the teeming masses. We are part of the working class, or what's left of the middle class, or what's left of the working poor. That's us. That's us. And what we are willing to accept, what level of poverty or well-being or prosperity, what we're willing to accept will determine the shape of democracy in this country and in the future. And what it seems right now, it seems as though we are willing to accept whatever that top 1 or 2% want to force on us. And their political cockroaches that they have put into positions of power in state legislatures, in governorships, in the U.S. Congress, and to a degree in the presidency. They are telling you and me exactly what to expect. And for some reason, we just 99.9% of us refuse to hear it. They are being very explicit. They are showing us what the future is going to look like. And what are we doing? What are we doing? I guess, you know, it goes back to a denial and avoidance. No, this can't be happening in the United States. No. Those jobs are going to come back. Those jobs are going to come back. The economy is going to get better. I will be able to send my kid to college. I will be able to buy a house. I will be able to pay off the mortgage. Really? Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Strange days indeed. Most peculiar, mama. Everybody's smoking, no one's getting high. Everybody's flying, never touch the sky. There's UFOs over New York, and I ain't too surprised. You know, I get a lot of emails from people who listen to this program and say, you know, you do a lot of complaining, but you don't have any solutions. And all I can say is, yeah, I do have a solution. I don't know how to implement it. That's the thing. This is one of the criticisms being leveled against the Greeks, is that other than the plan laid out for them by the international banksters, nobody in Greece, nobody in the political class, in the media, among the common folk, nobody presented an alternative to the so-called austerity moves. Nobody. And the answer to that is bullcrap. They said the only answer that was provided, other than the austerity measure, and this one was not workable. You see, when you control the game, you set the rules. It's very simple. If it's your ball,
You decide when it's kicked out of bounds. The answer is very simple. Let Greece go bankrupt. Who would be hurt? The Greek people wouldn't be hurt. It happened in Argentina back in, what, the 80s? After being cocked and primed by the international banking community, finally Argentina said, to hell with you people. The problem is the economic system that is like a plague on this planet. This predatory, vicious, merciless, vile capitalism that literally a few hundred people on Earth have figured out how to use in the most vicious, murderous way. And I mean that literally. You want a country's assets? You want to get in there and take their oil, their minerals, their gold, their whatever. You want to do that? Their water. You want to do that? Very simple. Conjure up some kind of a phony idea about terrorism or the potential for an attack and then invade them. And then set it up to look like their people hanged their leader. Or executed him by firing squad. Or ran him out of the country. Or whatever it is. And then set up your puppet regime. And if you can't set up the puppet regime, you've got the United States military behind you to go in there and raise all kinds of death and destruction. Until finally the country is so beaten down, it's very easy for the capitalists to move in and say, oh, look at this. Oh, well, here, we've got a solution. What's it called? What did Naomi Klein call it? Disaster capitalism? What an absolute term. Disaster capitalism. Well, there is a solution other than the one I just laid out, which is a solution for the banksters. What about the people? What about democratic socialism? What about market socialism, democratic socialism? As soon as you mention the word socialist or socialism in this perverted society, people either reach for their guns or look at you like you're, a communist. The average right-wing knucklehead can't tell the difference between communism, totalitarian communism, socialism. There is no distinction. Their political leaders, their preachers all have told them, ooh, socialism, bad. But the system that's killing you is good. Democratic socialism. Public ownership of banking. Now, that's the way it works in a credit union. Credit unions seem to be doing fine. How many credit unions have gone belly up? Oh, maybe a few because of mismanagement, maybe, but not because of the reasons that the banks go belly up. Have you ever heard of a credit union too big to fail? Nationalized banking. That means public ownership. Banking. Energy. Energy. In all its many forms. Exploration for oil. Gas, coal, up to a point, and then the development of fuels that are eco-friendly, that won't suffocate us, healthcare. We already have that. It's called Medicare, but it's only for people over a certain age. Why don't we have it for everybody? Who owns Medicare? Transportation. The rest of the world is developing high-speed transport, ground transport. What are we doing? What are we doing with the great rail system that united this country? Yeah, you know, for white people. United the country and made capitalism so much easier. Well, how about nationalizing transportation so that people can get around, so that when there's jobs available, they can get to them? Weapons production. Why not heed what Eisenhower said 60 years ago? Nationalize weapons production with the ultimate aim of that nationalization, the slow, persistent elimination of weapons of mass destruction and weapons of not mass destruction. Now, after instituting those reforms, then we provide financial and social encouragement for small businesses, family-owned farms,
high-tech firms, startup firms, all sorts of businesses that are left alone as long as labor and environmental laws are followed. So there's the answer to all you cockroaches who send me the disgusting emails about, you know, the things that you send me emails about. So there's a very quick, simple answer. Now, how to implement it? I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue as to how to implement it. But there is the solution. For anybody that wants to take a look, meanwhile, we have the laboratory of democracy, Greece, as an example, as it slowly, inexorably implodes. Man. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.